And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hello and welcome to Action Packed, the travel podcast. I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Together we've spent half a lifetime travelling to just about every corner of the world, making a living as travel writers out of what we like doing best.
And that's skiing, biking, beaches, hiking and a whole lot more.
Each week, Action Packed gives us the opportunity to share with you on the show some of these great experiences and the amazing people we meet along the way. Right now, real travel is limited to a daily walk around our local park, but the world will one day return to normal.
Meanwhile, dreams are risk-free and they're always available. You can find out more about us on our website, actionpacktravel.com. We'll regularly be posting links and show notes and loads of other useful stuff. If you like what you hear, please click on the subscribe button and listen to more episodes.
This week, we've flown virtually to Jersey and the Channel Islands to talk to intrepid traveller, crime writer Peter James. Now, Peter is Britain's best-selling author and the creator of Brighton Detective Superintendent Roy Grace. Global sales of his book top 20 million, and they've been translated into 37 languages. Roy Grace number 17, Find Them Dead, comes out in May, and we've been granted a sneak preview.
Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter and Felice.
Really nice to see you. Haven't seen you for a long time. But and now I gather you're living on Jersey, which is why we haven't seen you, because we used to live quite near you, near not so far from Brighton.
Yeah, I know. We moved here 2 years ago. It's just I wanted primarily to have a bolt hole for writing, but so we came over here with the intention of doing that and just fell in love with the island. And now we're living here full time. Still have a place in Sussex, but we're here most of the time and right now all the time. But it's a beautiful island. Both Laura and I are really kind of keen on sport, and I love cycling. And it's, although it's only 9x5, there's actually 500 miles of cycling roads and lanes. And people are respectful to cyclists here. Instead of in England, when they go past you at 80 miles an hour a foot from you, they actually sit behind you. It gets irritating sometimes because you think, come past. And they won't go by unless there's at least a car width they can clear. And the food is just fantastic. I love seafood. And it's got its own oyster beds, lobsters, the whole lobster's like 12 quid. It's friendly. You know, people don't lock their doors. You know, it's like going back in time, maybe 40, 50 years in England, except with high technology.
And have you been in touch with the local coppers?
I have indeed. I've actually loaned on permanent loan one of my race cars, an old BMW M3, which is now marked up as a Jersey police car. And they use it to engage with kids. And they let me indulge one of my dreams. One of my bucket list dreams, which is to drive a police car on blues and twos on a public road.
You probably wouldn't be able to do that in England, but you can do it.
No way, not in a million years. The police have been great over here. They've been really, really helpful to me every which way.
But a lot of people don't know that, apart from being obviously a very famous crime writer, you're a bit of a petrol head, aren't you?
I'm a kind of fairly serious petrol head, I think.
When we first met you, you had a much beloved Aston Martin. Do you still have that?
No, I've now, I've had several. I haven't. I've got Sacre Bleu. I've got a Porsche 911 now, because the Aston's too big for Jersey. The roads are quite narrow here. And they're fun to drive, even though it's a kind of tight speed limit. But I've got my big indulgences. I'm now racing a 1962 Corvette, a C1 Corvette, which kind of raced in period at Sebring and Daytona. So I raced that at the Goodwood Revival last September. So that's my big toy.
So you're doing quite a bit of classic car racing, are you?
Yes, I'm racing a Mini Cooper S as well, which I'm racing both of them at the Silverstone Classic in July. And I am down to race at Donington at the beginning of May, but I've got a feeling that's going to be cancelled. And hopefully at the Goodwood Revival again.
You had a pretty serious accident, didn't you, a while back?
Yeah, it was 2013 at Brands Hatch. I was racing. I had a 1965 four-door saloon BMW and 1800 Ti, and I was going into Paddock Hill Bend, which is one of the fastest and probably scariest bends on a race circuit, certainly in the UK. It's not anywhere in the world. And I got tapped by an old Lotus Cortina, and it knocked me sideways. And I went over four times at about 95 miles an hour, busted three ribs, damaged my spleen. And the car, ironically, had on its back, but I always just put the title of my latest book on my cars, and it had blazoned on the back, Dead Man's Time. And the marshal getting me out of the wreckage said, obviously not yours, mate.
It sounds like you were lucky, very lucky.
I was actually lucky. And I think it could have been a very much worse outcome. Luckily, that car had a really good safety cage.
So you do quite a lot of exercise to keep fit then, obviously.
I do, yes. I mean, after the accident, I had to... I'd always been a runner, and I had to stop running for a long time because of my three discs. But I found what really helped was Pilates and swimming.
Yeah, I did Pilates as well. I find it really good for the back, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. The Pilates, yoga as well. I do yoga. I got a yoga teacher comes twice a week. Swimming, and I find I do a lot of weights and general exercises. And touch wood, my kind of back's pretty much okay now. And I'm back doing a bit of running. Cycling slightly less impacted. And swimming, and of course skiing, and a bit of tennis as well.
So when you're in Jersey, what can you sort of describe a typical day in your life there? And will you do work most of the day, or do you have time to do other things, sort of go to the beach and that sort of thing?
How many hours do you write a day? That's the question, Mark.
Yeah, happy. And one of the great things about Jersey is that, and one of the things we wanted was to have slightly less distractions, because in England, I think it's a nice problem, but because I was in the, working in an office in England, people were constantly kind of dropping by. I wonder if people could sign this book, or want to do this, and then could I open this, could I open that? And I wanted to get away and just have a bit more time. And that was our initial reason, more than anything else, for going. And it's great. We have, we're actually doing things a bit more in the daytime together that we kind of weren't doing in England. But my typical day is I get up usually around 6:30, take the dogs out for about 30 minutes. On the way, I feed. We've got Indian runner ducks. So I feed the ducks. And we've got two lots of hens. So I feed the two lots of hens. And we've got pygmy goats, four pygmy goats. We've got, they're called Busco and Margot, named after wines. And Ted and Norman, named after serial killers. Then walk the dogs for about 30 minutes across fields, which we can go straight out onto from here. And then I, depending on the weather, I'll either swim for 30 minutes or do 30 minutes on a cross trainer or treadmill or just weights and gym. Have breakfast. I'm a big breakfast fan, I think. So it's a really important meal for me. I love cooking omelets and all kinds of eggs. And then I kind of get in my office and faff around, I think like most writers do, for a long time, trying to avoid settling down to write for as long as possible. Check emails, Twitter, Instagram, and then I'll write from about 10:15 to about 1:30. Then break, and Laura and I have kind of lunch. And then most days, I'll either play tennis in the afternoon or take the dogs for a walk. We might sort of go out and do something, or go out and just have some lunch somewhere. But my real best writing time is 6:00 in the evening till about 9:00. And that's when I really hunker down. It's my creative time. I start 6:00, have a stiff drink. It varies with each book. My default one is a vodka martini, currently I'm on gin and tonics.
So how long have you been on, is that for the new book, gin and tonics?
Or yeah, I've been on gin and tonics for the last 8 months. So I have one stiff gin and tonic, then two or three glasses of wine, put on music, and really get in the zone. Sometimes have a cigar as well.
What music do you like?
Very eclectic. I play a real mixture of kind of rock, jazz, everything from like Passenger, Van Morrison. And that's for the first like two-thirds of the book. And then the last third, I play opera arias. They kind of, I just find when I'm moving towards the climax, they really kind of just lift me.
How long does the whole book take to write?
About seven, Roy Grace is about 7 months from time I write the first sentence to the time I write the last sentence. And then it's another kind of 4 to 5 months in the editing process.
What sort of writer are you? Do you plan your books ahead or do you just go for it? How does it work for you?
I'm a mixture of plan and spontaneity, in that I people often ask me about writer's block. And the first question I say to somebody who says they got writer's block is, I say, do you know the ending of your book? And invariably they'll say, no. And I say, would you get in a car and start driving somewhere without having any idea where you're going? You know, whether you're going to be driving down to Dorset or to your local Tesco. And I find it's the same with writing. I always want to know the ending of the book. It gives me a vanishing point on the horizon. And I plan about the first 20%, and I plan the key high points. So I know the kind of, always plan three high points that I want to kind of, to give the book a shape. So I know very clearly where I'm going for about the first 100 pages, and I know the ending, and I know the key high points I want to hit. But then I really love it when I surprise myself as well. I think, if you don't surprise yourself, you're not going to surprise your readers. But every writer works in a different way. I mean, Lee Child just sits down and just starts writing. For me, I think an element of structure is important.
I mean, you intend to keep on writing. Roy Grace will keep going.
I always joke that if I was to retire, all I'd do is write a book, so I might as well keep going. But no, I mean, very luckily with Roy Grace, desperately sort of grateful to my readers, but the sales have just been continuing to rise with every book. And I love writing them. I find the world of the police endlessly fascinating. My new book, Find Them Dead, is about it's the first time I've actually written about a trial. So I've been in sitting with judges on the bench in a couple of murder trials. And it's just been fascinating. I just love getting to know sort of behind the scenes stuff.
What about research? I mean, Find Them Dead, I understand, has an Ecuador connection, South American connection. Have you been out there to research things, or do you not need to do that? I haven't read the book, so I don't know.
It's a great question, because I remember when I wrote my first ever book, which is a spy thriller called Dead Letter Drop. I basically made it was about a mole in MI5, and I made it all up. And then I wrote the second book. I had a two-book contract, and I had some key scenes set in Namibia, because it's a terrible book. Don't read it.
I have.
Latin Bomb Angel. You know, the story was about a guy whose father's a uranium mine worker in Namibia, and he contracts cancer and dies, and the son wants to get revenge on the Western world by blowing up a nuclear power station in England. So I had key scenes in Namibia, and I couldn't afford to go there at the time. So I got it all from a library. I met somebody who'd been out there, and I made a few notes. And I remember when the book came out, the first interview I did with a journalist, and she said to me, "Oh, you know, what was it like out in Namibia?" I went, "Oh, it was quite hot and sandy." And I thought, I've not only lied to this lady, I've lied to everybody who reads this book. And I just vowed never again would I write anything, any place that I hadn't been to. And so, yeah, we went out and spent 3 weeks in Ecuador in April last year.
So have you got any favourite destinations, favourite places you've been to do research for your books? Or perhaps least favourite as well? Or how about the scariest? There's another option.
Scariest have been sort of, some of the trips when I go out with the police, it can get kind of quite hairy at times. I was out with the police in Moscow and in a car and got shot at. I thought, that's quite interesting. I'm not sure I really want to be here. And then I had quite a funny one with them. I was out with Sussex Police. It was a few years back. It was a Thursday night, and I was with a young, very young sergeant and a very young Indian woman police officer, her first week out of what they call probation. And we're up in a really rough area of Think Estate. And there were 10 youths all walking down the street necking bottles of booze. And that's a criminal offence in Brighton. You cannot have an open bottle of booze on a public street. So they stopped and got out. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And these youths were really nasty, rude, and they were shouting abuse, racist abuse at this Indian woman. You know, nobody's going to take our fucking bottles off us. And I could see the sergeant radioing for backup. And I was, when I go out with the police, they usually give me a yellow jacket and it's either got police or observer on it. So I was just at the back and I happened to have my right hand in my pocket, which became a really good thing. I had my notebook out and I could see this was going to turn into a fight. So I'm thinking, do I leg it? Do I get in the car and lock the door? And I thought, well, all I can do is, if I'm going to save face, is I'll have to help the police and get stuck in, because backup can take 20 minutes, half an hour at a remote part of Brighton, that type of a busy Thursday night. So I started looking around for the smallest guy. I think I'll hit him first. Huh. One of them suddenly looks at me, points a finger and says, who the fuck's he? And I was standing there with my right hand in my pocket, and the sergeant, quick as a flash, said, he's with the FBI. And they must have thought I had a gun in my pocket, because they all turned into pussycats. They said, put their hands up, handed over their bottles. I thought, respect.
As well as playing tennis and cycling and motor racing, skiing is a passion of yours, isn't it? And we've skied with you, in fact, a few times.
We last skied in Jackson Hole, I think, was it? Or Jackson Hole or somewhere like that.
Yeah, I'm Val d'Isère one year.
But skiing is something that you was a passion early on in your life?
Yeah, my mother was Austrian, so I was taken skiing from the age of kind of five. And I was asked if I'd join or train with the British ski team when I was 15. My parents very luckily said no, because I was doing my O-levels at the time. And I honestly don't think, much though I love skiing, throughout my childhood, I'd go for a fortnight at Christmas with my mother and a fortnight at Easter, or mostly to Lech at Christmas and Zurs at Easter. But I remember I was in the minibus with Konrad Bartelski and I said, you know, how did you start? And he said, when I was about 17 and the four of us got a minibus and we'd drive down in November, get the first place in the Alps that had snow, get the first lift up, last lift up, 7 days a week throughout the entire ski season, then working in bars at nights. And I would not have had that dedication.
You like to go on holiday there, skiing holidays?
I just love it, yeah. And if I had to give up any holiday, I would give up a summer holiday. For me, skiing, I hated school when I was at Charterhouse. And I used to live for the times I'd be away skiing, just being up in the mountains. And I still love it. I'll go on skiing for as long as I can stand up.
And you've just been to Courchevel in the last week or two, which is kind of a tricky moment in our history. What happened there? Did you get skiing? Did you get to go skiing?
I managed 3 days before the resort was shut down on the Sunday morning for the COVID-19. Now, I like Courchevel. I mean, it's a funny place. There's one hotel there, the Shabby Show, which we've been going to for some years, but unfortunately it's now changed hands. We were the first year back under its new management and we only had 3 days, so we haven't really given it a chance, but it's sort of prices have gone up quite a lot and it hasn't got the sharpness and friendliness that we felt for several years under the family ownership. But we'll go back next year and give it one more go. But if not Courchevel, our favorite place for years was Zermatt, which I haven't been back to for about 8 or 9 years, but I'd love to give that another go.
Yeah, that's another favorite of ours as well.
What about for summer holidays? Do you have favorite places?
Yeah, for many years, I've gone down to the south of France to a place called Cavalière, which is about 20 miles east of Saint-Tropez. My parents had a flat very near there when I was a kid, so I spent all my sort of childhood summers down there, and I loved it, and I speak French. But we had a favorite hotel there. And that too was family owned, and that's just changed hands. So I've been sort of slightly blighted. I actually love going on a warm holiday in winter. This last summer, we spent most of it here in Jersey because it's such a beautiful place in the summertime. A couple of years, we've been to the Maldives in the once in January, once in November. In fact, twice in January and once in November. And the Maldives is definitely a big favorite. I don't know if you've been there.
No, we haven't.
So beautiful. You feel very safe there because the last touchwood, they are pretty much crime-free because every hotel is an island.
You must find it rather strange to go somewhere crime-free. I mean, it's your lifeblood.
Yes, I know. It's a bit boring, really. It's rather.
Do you write when you're away on holiday?
I try not to, but I make notes all the time. I think you guys are writers too. You probably know what it's like. You wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you know if you don't write something down, the next time you wake up, you've forgotten it and you'll be cursing yourself. So, but I don't, unless I'm really, really up against it. What I do on holiday is binge read. I don't like to read fiction while I'm actually writing because it's so easy to get influenced by somebody else's style. So I tend to save up all the books I really want to read. Once I'm on holiday, I can get through a book a day.
You're a fast reader.
Yeah, I find, although the more I'm enjoying a book, the more slowly I read it. I think if I'm really enjoying a book, then I'll slow right down and not wanting to miss the descriptions and things. But generally, I did a speed reading course at Toronto University when I was living out there in the 70s, and it's really stood me in good stead. Because I can, if I need to, read a book really fast, like 20, 30 minutes.
A lot of people don't know that you also have had another career in the movies as well. Is that something that you continue with?
No, I made a conscious decision back in 2005 when the kind of first Roy Grace book, Dead Simple, really took off. Big difference between writing and movie industry. Well, there's two really big differences. The first is that the movie business is culturally dishonest. Almost any money you make other than the fees you get paid get ripped off by the distributors, no matter how well a film does. Whereas a book, even if you make 30 euros photocopying charges in a Swedish public library, you actually get the money. But more than that, it's that the movie business is a collective always. So, you know, any film you make, there's 20 different people all claiming kind of ownership of the film. You know, you have your co-producers and say, it's our film, darling. And the director says, no, it's my film, darling. And the director of photography says, he's an asshole. It's really my film. I saved the film. And then your four lead actors say, actually, darling, it's our film. And then the production designer says, look, the film would have been complete shit if it hadn't been for me. Then the editor says, the film was shit. I saved it. I cut it together and made some sense out of it. And then the composer says, the film's a complete and utter fucking disaster. It's my music that's turned it into something worthwhile. Then the distributor says, oh, we don't like the ending. Can you reshoot? And you fight all the time, mostly with idiots. Huh. Whereas in a book, I don't have to change a single word. And I just love that. And also just that the egos that you're up against. I made a film with Peter Sellers many years ago, fun enough, actually, on our neighboring island of Guernsey. And afterwards, I made a cigarette commercial with him for Benson Hedges Gold Cigarettes. And I think he was most expensive day's pay for an actor in the history of motion picture industry at that time. I think Sellers got £100,000 for one day's work. This was in 1974, shooting a Benson Hedges Gold Cigarette commercial. It was Sellers, Spike Milligan, and Peter Villiers, and we were filming in Cyprus, and the basic setup was that Sellers are standing outside a bonded warehouse smoking a fag. Spike Milligan does a raid in a Macintosh with pouches. And instead of gold ingots, it's packets of Benson Hedges gold cigarettes. The alarm goes off. Sellers would run down the jetty into the getaway boat, and he's so laden down with all these packs, he goes straight through the bottom of the boat. So Sellers has flown in. And the director says, okay, Peter, first set up, you stand outside the warehouse, light the cigarette, you look nervous. Sellers says, I've decided I'm against smoking. I explained to him that the reason he's being paid the highest amount of money ever paid to an actor for one day's work is to make a cigarette commercial. He won't budge. I phoned his agent, Dennis Sellinger in London, and Dennis says, yeah, I'm sorry, Peter, can be tricky. And we had the agency there, Collett, Dickinson and Pierce. So they said, okay, look, why don't we just swap, have Spike smoke the fag, Peter does the raid. So we get Spike Milligan over and explain to him. And he says, solidarity with my friend Peter. I'm not smoking either. We get to midday. We've not shot one single frame of footage. And Peter Villiers says, oh, fuck it. I'll smoke the bloody thing. That's why I'm not in the movie business.
That's why you're not in the movie business. You've had a low points and high points here. I mean, that Spanish Fly was your famous low point, wasn't it?
That was definitely my low point. That was...
Tell us about that. You know,
well, there'd been a film with Leslie Phillips and Julie Edge called Not Now, Darling, which had become a huge success in many countries, in particular Canada, where I was living back at that time in the early 70s. And our Canadian distributor said, oh, could you produce something similar to that? So, and he said, but it'd be a good idea if we had another star in it that was known in America, because Leslie Phillips was not really a name in America. I said, who would you like? And he said, well, Terry Thomas would be perfect. So myself and my partner, we wrote a script called Spanish Fly with Terry Thomas and Leslie Phillips, all set in Spain. And it was basically a very tasteful story about Leslie Phillips is an underwear manufacturer, basically modeled on Janet Rager. And Terry Thomas is an old rogue living in Menorca, making cheap plonk, but doctoring its flavor and putting an expensive French Chateau label on. And Leslie Phillips arrives in Menorca to shoot an underwear commercial. And meanwhile, Terry Thomas's butler has by mistake ground some Spanish Fly beetle into a new stock of wine. And I don't have to explain the results. And the film came out. Barry Norman described it as the worst British film since the Second World War. And the least funny British funny film ever made. He did admit the following week on film night, he said, actually, I did trash that film, but my minicab driver said he really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It also had the misfortune of coming out the same week as Jaws.
And then there was a high point. Merchant of Venice was something that you're proud of having been involved in?
Immensely proud. Yeah, I ran the company that made Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino and Jeremy Irons, Joseph Fiennes. And that was a really happy experience. And I loved that film. I suppose partly because of my kind of Jewish roots through my mother. It's a play that's always been had very sort of Semitic overtones, and I remember the great review that we had by the Globe and Mail in Toronto, which said this is not an anti-Semitic play, this is a play about anti-Semitism, and I feel that's what we did with that play and that film, and I'm really, I'll always be pleased about it.
Changing the subject, I remember coming to your house once and seeing you had a stuffed crocodile or stuffed crocodile's head.
Yes.
You still have that.
I do indeed.
And other macabre things as well.
Yes. The crocodile has a sort of particular place in my heart because it was probably fairly significant in my divorce with my first wife. we'd been on... a Nile trip. We'd gone down the Nile and we'd taken this coach trip from Luxor to from Aswan across the desert. I don't know if you've ever done that, down to Abu Simbel. And it's 4 hours across arid desert. The coach, we were all getting back in the coach, and there was this, all these market stalls selling the usual tourist tat and, you know, plastic pyramids and stuff. And then I was just about to get on the coach and I saw this crocodile head. You know, it was about 3 foot long. So I rushed over and I said, well, how much is that? And the guy wanted about 300 quid. So I just turned away and he said, make me an offer. So I offered him £5. Mm-hmm. I got a torrent of abuse and I got the crocodile head for 15 quid. Mm-hmm. And I said, you better put it in something. So he gave me a bin liner. He put it in this bin liner and I got it back to the coach. And my ex, Georgina, said to me, what the hell is that? And I said, it's a crocodile head. She said, don't want it, leave it. I said, I'm not fucking leaving it. Let's pay 15 quid for it. So they got the coach driver, he put it in the locker. And we then had this 4 hour coach ride back across this searing desert. About 2 hours in, everybody started going. And I suddenly thought to myself, do you know, I didn't check. Is that just, I assumed it was stuff. Maybe it's just dead. People were gagging by the time we got back to the ship. And she said, throw it away. I said, I'm not bloody throwing it away. And we had a spare suitcase. We'd taken a couple of suitcases for buying stuff. So I got one of the suitcases out, and I got one of the cabin, the crew, to put it in the ship's freezer. And then we got it back to England, flew it back into Gatwick. And even by the time we got back down to Sussex, it was ponging again. It's not bloody coming in the house. So I left it in the garage overnight, and I got the yellow pages, and I found a taxidermist only about 10 miles from us. So I phoned him up and said, I've got this 3-foot-mile crocodile head. He said, I don't believe you. I said, well, I've just flown in last night with it. He said, well, I hate to think how many quarantine laws you've broken. Anyway, so I'll have a look at it. So I drive it over, and he said, you're not going to believe this, right? He said, my dad was a taxidermist before me. And he said, for 40 years, we've had in this drawer, and he opens the drawer and takes out a pair of glass crocodile eyes. So I have it mounted on a plinth, and I call it Georgina.
You've always had that's the macabre rather than the psychic, but you've always had a strong interest in psychic phenomena and things like that. How did that come about for you?
Well, initially it came about when, back in 1983, the son of really good friends was killed in a horrible car crash when a Frenchman drove the wrong side down the Paris-Lyon autoroute and killed their son and a friend he was traveling with. And long story short, the parents got persuaded to go to a medium, and they started seriously believing they were in contact with their son. And they asked me if I'd consider writing a book about their experiences. They felt it was helping them with their bereavement. And I got interested, and I started talking to more and more people about it. And I, for about a couple of years, I went to mediums, talked to priests, talked to exorcists. And one day I just had an idea. I thought, you know, lots of people go to a medium to get comfort if they lose a loved one. What about if a mother lost her son in a car accident, went to a medium to communicate with him, and discovered that he'd murdered his girlfriend? And I had no writing success before that. I'd had my 3 bad thrillers published, and I wrote this as a thriller called Possession, and it became an instant hit. It was every publishing house in Britain, major publishing house, bid for it. It went to number one here, and it went into about 23 languages. And my publishers then asked if I'd write more in that vein. And on the success of the book, but Georgina and I had always been townies, and we decided to do the dream and buy a big old country house. And we bought this beautiful, quite dilapidated Georgian manor house just outside Brighton, and the guy that we bought it from said, you're going to like this, what you write. He said, we got 3 ghosts. Actually, he lied, there were 4. And the house was very seriously haunted.
Did you see ghosts?
Well, the first day we moved in, this was in around about the, it's about 1988. The house had a big hallway. I've used it in my novel, the House on Cold Hill is based on that house. And there is actually a map of the interior of the house at the front of that book. But the house had a long porch and a long hallway, oak panel hallway, which went into an oak panel, like an anteroom, that you walk through to go into the kitchen. And I was standing with my then mother-in-law, who was a very down-to-earth lady. She was chair of the Brighton and Hove magistrates bench at the time. But she had a fey side to her. She'd always have a particular dream of somebody she knew was going to die. We were standing there guiding the removals men in. And I suddenly saw a shadow just move across the hall like that. And she looked at me and she said, did you see that? And I knew she'd seen something. We'd both been townies. You know, I'd lived in London, in Toronto, a bit of time in LA, but Brighton, and never in the remote countryside. And this house was on the edge of a hamlet, very isolated. And I didn't want Georgina to be spooked out on day one, so I said, no, I didn't see anything. And the next day, she went off to work. She was a solicitor in Brighton. And I went up to my office, and I went down about 10:30 to get a cup of coffee. I had to walk through this anteroom, and I saw tiny pinpricks of light, dozens of them, floating in the air. I thought it was my glasses catching light, so took them off, put them back on, gone. Then went down at lunchtime, same thing again. And it happened again in the afternoon. And Georgina came home from work. And I thought, well, I won't say anything. Maybe I'm just a bit spooked out by her mother yesterday. And the next day, same thing happened in the morning. And we had a dog, a Hungarian poodle called Jesse, and I took Jesse for a walk down the lane. And this old man came up to me. He said, oh, Mr. James. I said, yes. He said, you just bought the manor. I said, yes. He said, how are you getting on with your grey lady? Uh-huh. And I said, what grey lady? He said, oh, he told me he used to house sit for the previous owners because they had a place in Ibiza. And he said, one January, Sunday night, he said, I was sitting in that anteroom for the kitchen. We made it into a snug because it had the heat from the Arga. I had an armchair in there and a television. And this woman in grey silk crinoline with a really angry face just came out the wall, glided towards me. She flicked the edge of her dress, stung my cheek, and disappeared into the wall behind me. He said, I was out of there. He said, wild horses were not getting me back in that house. Yeah. I thought, great. So anyway, Georgina comes home in the evening, and I thought, you know what, maybe he's crazy. I won't say anything. And the following Sunday, her parents came to lunch. I took her mother-in-law, my mother-in-law aside, and I said, what did you see that day we moved in? She described this woman exactly.
Oh, wow.
So then I said to Georgina, I told her, she said, well, actually, I've seen her several times. I didn't want to tell you and worry you. Huh. We got a medium in, and medium said to me, you're slightly psychic, so what you're picking up is just bits of her energy. There's little pinpricks of light. He said, I think you really need to get a clergyman in here. So we had, I was very friendly with a guy called Dominic Walker, who at that time was vicar of St. Peter's in Brighton. He went on to become Bishop of Monmouth. But Dominic was also the chief exorcist of the Church of England at the time. They do believe it or not, both the Catholic and Anglican dioceses have diocesan exorcists. They don't call them that, they call them ministers of deliverance, but that's what they are. And he came to the house and he said, what I will do is I'll stand in this room and I'll try and tell her to go away. If that doesn't work, then I'll have to come back and we'll hold a full Requiem Mass funeral service. It's obviously an unrested spirit. So he just stood in the room and he said, go away! And everything calmed down with that particular one for the next 4 years. And it was nothing more with her in that room, except every time we went away, we'd always have somebody come and house sit and look after the dog. And there was one particular room upstairs where no one was staying. And I felt somebody was watching me if I went into it. But in 1993, I just had my thickest novel, Host, just came out. And I used to put a copy on this wooden chest in this anteroom. And I was having breakfast one morning about 7:45, and Georgina was upstairs getting ready to go to work. And she suddenly shouted out, I can smell burning. And I turned around, and this book in this room where we had all the haunting was on fire.
Wow.
And I lunged across, grabbed it, went in the kitchen, chucked it in the sink, and turned the tap on. And there was a perfectly prosaic explanation. There was a glass round paperweight sitting next to it, and the June sun had kind of refracted through. But,
yes, exactly. That's a strange tale, isn't it? Mm. Yeah. Of all the people that you've written about, all the things, Roy Grace is your number one. I mean, he's part of you, isn't he?
Well, he is, really, yeah. I mean, I think I'm just writing the 17th one in the series. I can't believe it when I started out writing that first one back in 2003, that I'd be writing the 17th one.
Get tired of him and the different characters and things? Are you?
No, I don't, because I'm very lucky in that Roy Grace is based on a real character. What happened was when I had written my sort of second bad spy thriller, I poured my heart out to a friend at Penguin, Lizzie Buchan. She's now a successful novelist herself. And she said, why are you writing about spies, darling? What can you ever know about the world of spies? We're up against people like John le Carré, who come out of the security services. You'll never be able to access that world. You've got to write about something you can access and you can research and that you're passionate about. And around that time, we got burgled and a young detective came to take fingerprints. And he saw my books. And he said, well, if you ever want research help, give me a call. Research help with the police. And he was married to a detective. And Georgina and I became friendly with them. They invited us to barbecue at the house. And all their friends were cops. You know, everything from homicide, traffic, response, soccers. And I just found talking to these people, wow, I thought, you know, nobody sees more of human life in a 30-year career than a police officer. Probably only a journalist sees remotely as much, but the cop has that extra thing that they can go anywhere behind the scenes all the time. And when they realized, and over the next few years, we started making a number of friends among the police. And when they realized I was just genuinely interested, they started inviting me out on patrol. And one day, one of them in about 1996 said, oh, there's a homicide DI you might quite enjoy meeting called Dave Gaylor. And I went to his office and we just kind of clicked. And he said, you know, what are you writing at the moment? And I was writing a psychological thriller called Denial. He said, tell me about it. So I started telling him, he said, hang on a sec. No, 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 your character wouldn't have done that. Why hasn't he got an outside inquiry team doing this? And I don't think she'd have behaved quite that way. And I thought, wow, this guy's got a really big bandwidth. And it's something that I've learned subsequently, that good homicide detectives, quite unlike the portrayal we tend to see on television, where they tend to be grumpy and shouting at people, tend to be have a very high degree of emotional intelligence. And they have also two completely contrasting character traits. One is that they are incredibly anal, because every major crime is hundreds, if not thousands, of tiny pieces that have to be fitted together. But a lot of them are solved by sudden blue sky thinking. And Dave Gaylor had both these attributes in spades, and we became mates. And over the next 5 years, he rose to become Detective Chief Superintendent, basically head of major crime for Sussex in 2002. And that was when Pam McMillan approached me and said, have I ever thought of creating a detective as a central character? So I said to Dave, how would you like to be a fictional cop? And he kind of loved it. And we've become even closer friends. He was best man when Laura and I got married. We get together every couple of weeks. I had an hour and a half on the phone with him earlier today, planning the next book. He reads every 100 pages, tells me how Roy Grace and other cops would think and act. And that's been a big part of, I think, the success of Roy. And that I think people who read are smart. Anyone who reads is intelligent. And I think we like to, when we read, we don't just want a good story. We want to learn stuff about the world in which we live. And readers can tell immediately if the research is accurate or not accurate. You know, it's a lesson I learned going back to that book I set in Namibia. That, you know, always write, you know, always underpin your writing with research. And you know, so I think my relationship with Dave has been a fundamental part of the success of Roy Grace.
That your latest book, Find Them Dead, is to be published on May the 14th. Can you give us just a brief synopsis of what it's about? This is another Roy Grace book, yeah?
Another Roy Grace, yeah. It's about, Find Them Dead is about essentially a 42-year-old widow called Meg McGowan. And 5 years earlier, her son and a teenage son and husband were killed in a car crash coming back from a family holiday. And she and her teenage daughter survived, and they're immensely close. And her daughter is now on a gap year, traveling in South America. And Meg gets called up to jury service, and she gets on the trial of a major Brighton-based County Lines drug dealer. And on the end of about the third day of the trial, she goes home, and there's a photograph of her daughter taken in Ecuador, sitting on a kitchen table. And at that moment, a phone rings. And a voice says, we know where your daughter's going to be every moment of every day. If you ever want to see her again, at the end of the trial, you have to get the jury to say just two words, and you know what they are.
Peter, thank you very much. Find Them Dead, to be published on May the 14th. Good bookshops everywhere. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the show, and the best of luck with the book.
Yeah, so good to talk to you guys.
Yeah, you too.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Stay safe and we'll see you next week.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.